We're talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. as we approach the observances of his birthday coming up on Monday, January 18th. That is the actual holiday. There are, as you heard, some ceremonies and observances coming up to that time as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy and move forward into as well talking about observances that may be going on in your town. Join us on the Exchange as we talk to D.L. Richardson, who is an MC at the Ashland event on Monday, former professor at Southern Oregon University, native of Selma, Alabama. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. D.L., welcome back to the Exchange. It's been a few years.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
I should have left out that you're actually a former fill-in host as well on the Exchange.
True enough.
Many years ago.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, and it's a lot of fun. I remember how great the listeners were.
Yeah, this is a great audience to work with, for sure. I guess for me, it always gets back to you coming from Selma, Alabama, which has the additional layer of, since the last time I talked to you, we have the movie Selma out.
Absolutely.
As well. Give us some riffs on your thoughts about that and about the Selma's place in history.
Well, the movie itself was just amazing for me to watch. And for a while, though, I had to watch it twice because for the first time, it was all about the historical aspect of it for me and going and having or growing up in Selma, looking at the things that were going on in the movie and thinking to myself, wait a minute, that didn't quite happen that way. That didn't quite happen. They didn't come across the bridge from that angle, you know, those type of things. Or, you know, that wasn't where the restaurant was where Reverend Reed got beat, because that's a laundromat. That's not where that was. So it was all those type of little things. But as for then watching it again, just as the understanding the importance of the movie and seeing what they did, it was incredible for me. I thought it was a great thing.
The ceremony coming up for Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday on Monday in Ashland, where you're the MC. You've been the MC for a couple of years at this event, haven't you?
Yeah, I started MCing I got to Ashland as an instructor in 2001, and I started MCing in 2004. 2004.
Like 13th year or something.
Yeah.
Like,
so okay. It's been exciting. It's been a great thing. I love the community. I love the support of the community. It's amazing because coming from Selma, the first thing I always thought was, well, this is Ashland. You know, I don't know enough about this place. I don't really understand it. I'll see what happens. And I really didn't expect there to be many people the first year I went in 2002 because it was snowing. There was snow on the ground. It was probably about a half a foot of snow on the ground. And, you know, from Selma, you know, and from the state of Alabama, if there's a threat of an inch of snow, we shut the whole state down.
Right.
You know, so I didn't think anyone would be there. And I get there, and there's people all outside the building and lines going from, at that time, it was actually in a Brit Ballroom here on campus, and the lines were going all the way to Stevenson Union. And so it was just, that was the first incredible moment. And what I've always said about this particular event is that in ways, it's even better and the envisionment of King and what he wanted is more about what you see in Ashland than it was in Selma. And because I went to so many different events there in Selma and in Montgomery and in Birmingham, all of the key spots of the civil rights movement. But the way people come together, all of the different ethnicities, all of the different cultures that come together in Ashland to create this event, it's just incredible to me. And I think that's something King would have just cried over, that he would have loved being here for.
In the examples you cite in the South, I mean, are there very few white faces at the MLK celebrations in those cities?
Absolutely. There are some, you know, the dignitaries will come out for the particular, at what particular church. I grew up and born and raised in a church called First Baptist in Selma. There are two major churches in Selma during the civil rights movement where so much tended to happen. One was Brown Chapel AME Church, and the other was First Baptist Church. And don't get me wrong, all of the churches took part, but those were the two largest churches in the town, and that's where so much tended to happen. Many of you might remember that there was a little controversy going on when Hillary Clinton spoke at First Baptist Church, and you know, she was too Southern. You know,
she dropped her G's and things,
right,
is what people
exactly.
said, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So when you go from there, but that's what I mean. You know, they would come, we would invite these different city dignitaries, and they would show up for that, and then they would walk out, and they'd never hear from them again. And so you really saw the majority of just the black population really holding on to this idea of the importance of the MLK Day. It's gotten better from what I understand. Every time I go home, it seems like there's a little bit of there's a little bit of stepping forward, but also of stepping backwards. Unfortunately, I think, and there's a lot of still a lot of division in that town, and it bothers me. It really does to think that my hometown has not grown as much as this, I think the country has grown. It really saddens me sometimes to head back and see that.
Dale Richardson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a former professor at Southern Oregon University, native of Selma, Alabama, and he'll be the MC at Ashland's observance of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday on Monday, January 18th. So when we talk about progress in the country, first of all, you mentioned going home. You go to Selma, what, yearly or something?
I try to get there each year. Sometimes it's every other year. I was there this past year in 2015. And just, again, yeah, I try to get home yearly. And some of the things we have not grown, as I've said before, and other areas we tend to be doing this, we're doing well, but there's still a lot of division in a little town like that. One of the things I always bring up when I think about the differences, growing up in Selma, I have an older sister that's 10 years older and a younger sister 7 years younger, and my older sister, I remember going to the high school games with her. And there was such a clear separation of race in that town of black and white, where they sat at the high schools.
Even though the high school itself was integrated?
Yes, even though the high school itself. She was in the fourth class of the integration, 14th class of integration of Selma. And so when you watch at the high school games, you see, you know, one side is white, one side is black. I mean, it was so divided. Then, but again, in her high school, it was 90% white, 10% black, as far as doing her graduating class. When I came through 10 years later, it was more of a 60-40 white to black. Mm-hmm. And when you went to a high school game, you saw a lot of integration. People sat together. People enjoyed each other. There was still a race element, but people enjoyed being together at the high school game. Then by the time my sister came through, and 7 years later, because of events that had happened, it was more 90% black to 10% white, and you saw that separation again. And I actually went to see my youngest niece actually be on the flag team at a high school game. I went back 1 year to see that, and there's that clear separation yet again. And blacks didn't set with whites, and they didn't see, even though black and whites are on the same team, they're on the same in the same band together, all of these things. No one sat together. It just took me right back to that time with my younger sister. So there was more of an understanding or more of a togetherness, or I guess I'm trying to think of a term, but my sisters had a better understanding or understood together more of growing up in Selma at that particular high school than I had. I'm not making sense, I know, but
it sounds like there was just a better blending at
better
times.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. In that matter, it's just so interesting that when you go back and just take a look at, you would think that my younger sister and my nieces would have had more blending, in the sense of there would have been more black and white sitting together, but that wasn't the case.
What accounts for the difference that you just mentioned, though, where after a while it was like 90% black and 10% white? Did Selma open up another public high school, or did the whites decamp for private schools?
Went to private school. There was a major battle that tended to happen. One of the civil rights leaders of the town started – there was a situation that happened where people really start realizing that there was trying to be a segregation still in place of blacks and whites in Selma and in the Selma public school system. And the problem with that was that they created a system called casting. And pretty much if you were white, you were in level one. If you were black, you're in level two, that type of thing. And so what the civil rights leaders were attempting to do, and again, this was in we're talking in the late 80s, early 90s, what they were attempting to do was to get rid of this caste system, you know. And I think that was it was something that needed to be done. It was something that needed to be done for the students and for the children of Selma, because otherwise they just felt in the same manner that, well, we're never going to be good enough. We can't get to this point. If you're not in level one, levels is what it's called. If you're not in level one, you're not going to be a part of the computer training. If you're not in level one, you're not going to be a part. If you're in level two, you're average. And if you're in level three, you're never going to get anywhere. And that was the way the school system was set up. And so it was the same thing as segregation. You had this in your mind that I can never get to this point because I've been already put in this level. I've already been cast in this system that I can't get out of. And it's amazing to me that so many students went to college out of Selma with that mentality.
D.L. Richardson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is a former professor at Southern Oregon University, a few times host of the Jefferson Exchange in years past, a longtime friend of the program, and he'll be emceeing the Martin Luther King Jr. event coming up on Monday, January 18th in Ashland. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to reflect on the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King and the state of race relations in the world today. Or if you have an event you'd like to publicize about Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in your town, by all means, give us a call, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Going to college out of Selma reminds me that when I worked in Alabama for a couple of years in the early 80s in Huntsville, we had the University of Alabama Huntsville, the traditional white school, and Alabama A&M University, the traditional black school. There were, throughout southern states, it seemed, separate educational institutions for people of color. Has that changed much in the years since? I mean, has there been any more integration in those schools?
I think there has been. If you watch, my oldest sister went to Alabama State University. And again, as you say, and I have several friends that went to Alabama A&M. And as you say, those different school systems, the different universities are great, were great universities. They were only universities that would allow people to get a higher education, African Americans get higher education. And interestingly enough, I think there's more of an integration of white students into places like A&M and State, then they're obviously that's a great deal of integration in the other state schools, the larger state schools, University of Alabama, which I was a part of, University of Auburn. Boy, Hurst even said that word.
But sorry.
That's okay. We're okay. We just won a national championship. We're okay. But but there's so much more accepting of white students coming into traditionally black universities, and I think that's a great thing. As far as the black students going into and African American students going into traditionally white universities, that's very much the National Merit Scholars. I remember a few years ago, University of Alabama had become the number one school nationwide for National Merit Scholars, which was primarily short minority students. And that's an incredible step when you think that the governor at one time stood in front of the gates to say, yeah, I'm not letting you into my school. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible steps. And so, yes, education at the lower level, that's where we tend to have the bigger concern at the elementary, well, not the elementaries, but more of the high schools. There's still people who talk about race wars at some of the high schools. There's still black and white students that separate at the segregation that happens at the high schools. But there's also, with each step and with each generation, you see them getting better and better, I think. And I just hope that continues. That's what we pray for.
The family you still have in the South, what do they make of the political system and the wrenching changes of the past 20 years or so? Because we're talking about they may have been conservative Democrats, but they were Democrats for whom black voters would vote in the South in Congress since the Gingrich Revolution, and the South realizing, oh, yeah, conservatives tend to be Republicans. Voom, everything has gone very heavily Republican,
right, I think
which would tend to dilute the voting power.
Especially with the Clinton administration, if the memory just happened. That was one of the big ones because Richard Shelby was one of the big councilmen or senators in Alabama that switched over from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. I've never really enjoyed that idea. No, I have nothing against either side, or Democrats or Republicans, but I always think if you get voted in one party, you should stay. and if you want to step away, then fine, and then run again. That's just my personal thing. A lot of people won't share that, but that's just me personally. When you look at the political aspect, Selma's gone through so many changes because you have to remember that when Bloody Sunday happened, and Bloody Sunday was 1965, the Voting Rights March that happened from the marchers marched from Selma to Montgomery, the original marchers were met at the Pettus Bridge, where it's very interesting, again, where the governor had declared that they weren't going to march any further than the bridge. And then once they come through, the state troopers were there to stop them. And we call it Bloody Sunday because of all the violence that happened and the African-Americans who were completely literally trampled upon during that time.
And a bunch of heads split open with clubs.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You see the pictures of it. I have so many of my relatives or friends or people in my community that I grew up with that I knew. I remember as a professor, you start looking at those things even more and you say, you think about, wait, there's my babysitter getting her head split open. You know, you didn't put it into context then, but years later you start thinking about just what they went through. Just bothers me so much when my former students would talk about not voting. They didn't really think it was important enough to vote. And I think about what they went through, what my friends, my family, my relatives went through just so they could get an opportunity to vote and give these kids an opportunity to vote. And they're wasting that vote.
You know, people shed blood to get the
blood,
right to vote.
It's as though you just said this person's life wasn't important enough for you to go and put your name on a piece of paper and say, I vote for this person or not. So that's the important part to me. I think we need to take away that it's not just someone was talking and trying and doing a speech or what have you. It's the, as you said, shed blood so that you could have a better life. How do you throw that away?
How much of your own experience did you take into the classroom with students when you taught communications and journalism at Southern Oregon University?
Quite a bit from the civil rights aspect because for what I was smart enough, well, I wasn't smart enough to do it. One of my professors was smart enough to tell me, why don't you do this, was to, for all of the people that I could get in contact with before they, because I knew they were in the process of them passing away. And so I got quite a bit of audio interviews. At the time, we weren't doing any, I didn't have a smartphone. You know, we didn't do things back then. But I got quite a few audio interviews, and I'm able to take, I would show the students different videos of what was, you know, that's out there that we could see. But then I would let them listen to, in their own words, what they were thinking. Arthurine Lucy, who was the first person to try to integrate, first black person to try to integrate the University of Alabama, or Fred Shuttlesworth, or Fred Shuttlesworth, who was a major player in the Birmingham Civil Rights Movement, or Fred Gray, who was the first, Arthur Schultz and Fred Gray were the first blacks to be, to pass the bar in the state of Alabama and was so important in the NAACP movement. So I wanted my students to be able to hear in their own words, and I think that was one of the best things I could have possibly done because I talk too much. But if I let them listen to it in their own words, I've always had them coming back years later telling me how much they really appreciated that.
More of the words of D.L. Richardson here on the Jefferson Exchange as we continue with the program. We're talking about Martin Luther King Jr. and race relations in the country more broadly. D.L. himself is a native of Selma, Alabama, as you've heard, and a former professor at Southern Oregon University. And he'll be emceeing the MLK event in Ashland on Monday, as he's been doing for more than a decade now. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with D.L. Richardson, your thoughts about race relations, your discussions about MLK events in your own town, here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our discussion this hour is about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as we approach the birthday observances on this Monday, January 18th, which is a holiday for a number of people as well. There'll be celebrations in a number of communities, including in Ashland, where the city celebration will once again be emceed by our guest, D.L. Richardson, who's a former professor of journalism and communications at Southern Oregon University and a native of Selma, Alabama. And he's been emceeing the program for, this will be his 13th time, it looks like. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about the legacy of Dr. King, about race relations in America today. And if you need to talk about events in your own town, if you'd like to publicize events in your town for MLK, please give us a call at 800-838-3760 or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. It seems like there are few years that we could call uneventful in the ways that people get along in the United States, particularly the last several. How much, as MC and working with the producers of the MLK observance in Ashland, do you incorporate the very real and very hard, in a lot of cases, to digest facts of recent years?
Well, it's important for us that we not, obviously, MLK Day is about the historical aspect of what has been done and what has been achieved. But at the same time, we try to keep it, as we say, alive. We keep the dream alive. That's the idea. And what would King do at this particular time in life? What would he do of the things that are going on right now? Would he sit idly by and do nothing, or would he continually try to address the issues? And that's what we try to do with the program. We have every year we set down, Claudette Alec and the committee, who's our producer, she sets down with the committee, and we all come up with the theme to think about what it is we need to be doing and how we need to be addressing what's going on in the community at the time and in the country at the time. And you can pretty much see that with this year's theme, you know, being let us be dissatisfied. And so in that idea, we want to go with, okay, what is going on within our nation, what's going on in our community, and how do we address that in this program? And how do we make people realize that what King envisioned has not completely come to fruition yet, and how do we help people understand that we have so much left to do, and we need, and what do we need to do to continue that on? So we bring in different events, we bring in different people, we bring in different ideas about what's going to elevate that particular theme, as you would with anything, and we try to incorporate that into our program each year.
It's an interesting theme, though. Let us be dissatisfied.
Right, right. It comes from the King speech. I mean, let us be dissatisfied and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. That is the whole dream speech. And the speech itself comes from, or that particular quote comes from one of his speeches, Where Do We Go From Here?, which was a 1967 speech that he did for Operation Breadbasket. And Operation Breadbasket, just for your listeners, just to give you an idea, King decided through SCLC that it was an opportunity that we need to go further from where they're going. I mean, we'd had the march on Selma, we'd had the march in Birmingham. Now where are we? What do we do now? Where do we go from here? And Operation Breadbasket was an opportunity for members of the SCLC to galvanize their membership, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to galvanize their membership in the South and in the North, bring ministers together to try to bring churches together to try to elevate African Americans. What was going on is that you have all of these businesses that still were not concerned about the African American plot. And what I mean by being concerned is that, let's say Coca-Cola, my favorite drink. you may have Coca-Cola, but how many African Americans drink Coca-Cola? Okay. Now, how many African Americans work at the Coca-Cola plant? How many African Americans hold a position in the hierarchy of Coca-Cola? These were the things that King and SCLC started thinking about. We need to help elevate our communities, and the businesses that we support should be helping us elevate them. If you have no but one, well, you know, it's funny. You still hear the same type of thing, say, on the NFL. How many African-American coaches do you have compared to how many African-American players you have in the NFL? Same type of thing. So what Operation Breadbasket did was to start boycotts, to say, look, if you can't support us, then we can't support you. One of the lines out of that speech was, if you respect our dollars, you have to respect us as persons as well. And so if you're not going to do that, then maybe we don't need to give you the money.
Yeah, if you're going to take our money, be nice to us.
Exactly. And so that was such a major program that got going. He calls it probably the most successful program that they did, especially in the North. In fact, it was the program, this particular speech, that really put Jesse Jackson at the forefront. This is where Jesse Jackson became the Jesse Jackson that we knew of as a civil rights leader. I'm trying to think how I can say that nicely, so I'll leave it that way.
It drew him into the civil rights movement.
Exactly. Yeah. Drew him into the civil rights movement. He was already a theological seminary student. He became a member of the SCLC, and it's from this program that led him to create PUSH, out of Chicago, the very successful program there. And so when we look at this and we look at that theme, he was talking at that time about being dissatisfied, not wanting to give up on the idea that, look, you have to respect us. We have so much further we need to go, and we need you to be able to say, look, I'm going to put money into your banks as corporations. I'm going to put money into your banks. I'm going to in your community banks. I'm going to put employees. I'm going to hire employees out of your community. These are the things that we have to do. And so we're looking at the same way as a community now. How are we dissatisfied? How are we at a point of saying we're not where we need to be as a community, as a country? We're dissatisfied with these particular things. How are we going to make them better? What are you dissatisfied about as a member of your community, and what are you going to do to make it better? You know, it's one thing to just say it, but what are you going to do about it?
Well, that's the thing, is that you get the lofty rhetoric on one hand, and right. everybody knows at least the phrase, I have a dream, but right. the fact is that beyond lofty rhetoric, there have to be nuts and bolts actions
exactly.
to implement your campaign, and things like boycotts were very much a part of it. In fact, people often forget Dr. King died in Memphis when he was helping organize sanitation
like
workers to get
yeah.
to get more money. Which raises the question, have we forgotten activism in America, do you think? Have we forgotten how to organize ourselves? Because it seems like things like voting with your pocketbook and boycotting or not spending money on the people who displease you, it still gets said a fair amount, but it doesn't seem like it gets done as much as it used to.
I think I had that concern at one point, and then Black Lives Matter came about, and all of the protests have been about out of Ferguson or out of New York, out of Chicago, all of you're looking and going, wait a minute. No, we haven't forgotten. We haven't forgotten how to organize. We haven't forgotten how to fight for what we believe in. We haven't forgotten how to actually say, look, you just can't treat us any type of way. You have to respect, again, us as people. And again, when I say us, I'm saying us all, not just African Americans, but everyone. You have to respect us. And I think we have learned, we have remembered and come back to this organization aspect of how do we do it? What are the right ways to go about doing these things as well? Because we can always go to a violent aspect, but the idea that so many people still are realizing nonviolence still has a place. And in nonviolence, it tends to do more than just the instantaneous effect of a violence. But that nonviolence seems to have a lasting effect. And that's what King wanted to push forth. And that's what he pushed forth in this particular speech.
D.L. Richardson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. He'll be the MC at Ashland's event on Monday, January 18th. We have an email here from Joe in Talent. He says, Dr. King has been a huge part of my life. In the 1960s, as a very young teenager, I was able to march with my folks in local protests supporting integration in and around Central Florida and be exposed to the inequality that was institutionalized in the South. As an adult while living in Orlando, I was blessed with the adoption of three black brothers, adding to my brood of five very pale Irish-Italian kids. To see how seamless their relationship was reaffirmed what Dr. King wanted for our society and was a living manifestation of the dream. We all have a common root. We all want the same things in life. And on Dr. King's birthday, we take a few minutes in our family to remind each other we are better together than apart. That's from Joe and Talent.
That's exciting. That is very exciting. I mean, you tend to think about during this time, it is one of those things that push forth. And again, it's what we try to do with the MLK celebration and the committee is, okay, what do you do after this day? You know, do you just put this aside and not think about it again for 365 days?
Right.
Or wonder? No, what do you do after this day to continue on? And it sounds like that family does a great job.
You know, I'm impressed by the fact that, as you mentioned, that Ashland gets such a big crowd out there that there's actually an overflow. There's like a closed circuit simulcast
someplace.
Absolutely.
We are in an amazing, after 27 years, this is our 27th year, and tells you that Ashland has been at the forefront for some time, and I'm so impressed with the community and what they do and how they continue this on. But yeah, we've had the overflow for a few years now. The Armory has we always get to the Armory donated. We have so many people that donate to the success of this program, from the signs that we have that hang over the in Ashland or through downtown when you come in and you see it, from the donation of the Armory to the donation of time and hours that come into play in everything that we do. But yes, this year we're doing the overflow. Last year I think it was in I completely forgot. Okay. I can't remember.
It's in the varsity this year, though.
Yeah, but this year is at the varsity. Sorry about that. But this year is at the varsity. John has done a wonderful job donating this space for us. And so we do a live feed straight to the varsity. So what happens is that so many people come out, and we let as many people as we can in, and then we give us enough time to let people know that, yeah, just right up the street, you can head to the varsity, and you're going to have the opportunity to share the program with us live at the same time. And so it should be, we hope you can enjoy that and come and be a part.
Let's talk about an event last night at the President's State of the Union Address. This is the last State of the Union Address of Barack Obama, because he won't be president when it's time for that address next year.
Right.
But he didn't call out Donald Trump by name, but he was quite clear in his words that as we move into this year and begin to select new leaders, we need to think in terms of whether we're appealing to our base instincts or the better angels of our nature. I didn't use those words, but the basic idea there being that you've got the likes of Donald Trump, again, who was not mentioned by name, but calling out specific minorities or religions for scorn. This is I don't know if this is a plan that anybody's going to address that directly in the MLK celebration on Monday, but it's something that is certainly part of the fabric at the moment.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting is the things that span out of the MLK event. One such thing is the interfaith conversation that would be happening that night. And I think that's going to be a very interesting conversation, and Donald's name will probably be brought up a few times as we come into play. You know, I just think I look at Donald and I look at other people who, on the very edge, it just reminds me so much of the powers that be during the civil rights movement that so... They didn't actually come, during the civil rights movement, they actually did come out and talk about hate and let that hate spew out. But this whole subtlety of hate that comes out really bothers me. I've got no problems with someone's opinion, but when you put that opinion as what you think it should be for the entire country. And that because you think one way, you think this country needs to completely take that hate on, it bothers me. And that's what I hear. I hear hate. I have to be honest with you. I don't hear patriotism. I don't hear love for my fellow man. I hear hate. And that tends to bother me a great deal on this particular case. And I appreciate the fact that there was not a name put forth. But when you hear such rhetoric, you realize that has no place in this country. I mean, this country is based on the multicultural aspect of and that's what made it great. And when you think about the fact that this particular person in general, his whole community, what were they thought of at the time when this country first got started? Were the people who tried to keep his community out of the American dream? And it was. You would think that you could think back on your own legacy and realize, hey, I don't need to keep push that on someone else.
Yeah, the idea that the English wanted to keep out the Irish and the Germans, and then
exactly.
the Irish and the Germans and the English wanted to keep out the Italians, and then all of them wanted to keep out the Poles. It's a long string in American history that
yep.
we hope will be broken someday. Martin Luther King Jr. will be celebrated on Monday, January 18th in Ashland. D.L. Richardson, our guest today, will be emceeing the ceremony. Thanks so much for joining us today in the Exchange.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Also want to thank Mildred Ruiz Sapp and Stephen Sapp of Universes, who will be the keynote speakers at that observance, for joining us earlier in the hour.